The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Johnson, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 15th, 2022, and this hearing is being held via Zoom.gov. An audio recording of today's hearing will be available on the court's website. We have five cases for oral argument on the agenda today. I would observe to the attorneys that a time clock should be visible if you are using the gallery view option on Zoom. And I would remind you to please mute your microphones when you are not speaking. And with those introductions, I will call the first case. The first case on the agenda today is A220876 in the matter of the civil commitment of Madonna Margaret Feiner. Good morning, counsel. So today you've each been given 15 minutes for oral argument, and appellants, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. For each of you, before you begin today, if you would please identify yourself and your client for the audio record, that'd be much appreciated. And with that, are you prepared, Mr. Winkler?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning, everyone. My name is Stephen Winkler on behalf of the appellant Madonna Feiner, and may it please the court. Today we are seeking essentially two forms of relief in this matter. The first is based on Minnesota Statute 253B.09, that when a person is committed, the order requires the court to provide findings of fact and conclusions of law that specifically state the proposed patient's conduct that forms the basis for determining the commitment. In their brief, the respondent concedes that the order lacks the necessary findings and conclusions. And so we're asking that this matter be remanded to the district court with instructions to comply with the statute. And unless there are questions on this issue, I'll move on to our second argument, which is the other form of relief we're seeking, which is the reversal of the commitment, both the commitment on for chemical dependency mental illness.
Mr. Winkler, I'm correct that you did not file a reply brief, correct?
That is correct. Yes, I did not.
So in light of respondents' response to your responsive argument to your opening brief, is it your preference that we go forward to the second argument in your brief, or is it your preference to simply reverse and remand for those findings before we engage in appellate review of the substance of the commitment?
My preference is that the court consider our second argument before simply remanding back to the district court, in that despite the lack of findings and conclusions in the order, the court is able to review the evidence at this point de novo and make a determination as to whether sufficient evidence exists for either of the commitments. So I'm asking the court for consideration today on that before it's just remanded.
Isn't that sort of inconsistent with your first argument, which we may adopt in light of the party's agreement on it? But I mean, I think the underlying rationale of your first argument is that it's impossible for the court to conduct effective appellate review without adequate findings. But so if we agree with you on that, but then how can we go forward and actually do appellate review?
I would say that the order certainly lacks the requisite findings. However, as the court is able to review the evidence de novo, it doesn't require specific findings and conclusions in the order itself to make a determination as to whether the underlying evidence is simply there to support the commitment. I guess what I'm arguing here is, even if the order had provided the necessary specificity of findings and conclusions, the underlying evidence still would not support whatever those findings and conclusions might be.
And is there, and I'll just one more question, and then I'll let you proceed to that argument. But I guess, is there case law saying that this court may or should proceed and to analyze the underlying evidence in the absence of findings, or is that an open issue that, you know, but where there's no particular guidance?
I believe that's an open issue. And I would acknowledge there are several hundred cases dealing with seeking remand or reversal on CD and MI commitments. So there certainly is the potential that it has been addressed before, but if it has, I did not find it. So at least to the best of my knowledge, it's an open issue.
Thank you.
Yes. Moving first, I would like to address the commitment as chemically dependent or CD. Looking at statute 253B.02 subdivision 2, which provides the definition for what a person who is chemically dependent under the statute provides. The first requirement is that there's a demonstration that there's an incapability of self-management due to habitual and excessive use of alcohol. And both Dr. Reitman, who was the court-appointed examiner, and Dr. Marshall, who wrote the report regarding competency, or the 20.01 report, both acknowledged that appellant's apparent or alcohol use is unknown. Both reports quote, well, Dr. Reitman's report quotes extensively from Dr. Marshall's report and the pre-petition screening report, which rely heavily on appellant's daughter's reporting, who first reported that she had not had contact with her mother for 6 months prior to her meeting with the team. But despite that, I think a quote that she provides is actually spot on. She says that two DUIs, or driving under the influence, which is what Ms. Thiner was arrested for, suggests a concern about her drinking. And I think that is exactly right. It does certainly suggest a concern about her drinking, but it does not demonstrate that Ms. Thiner's use is habitual or excessive, or that she's incapable of self-management due to alcohol use. Her daughter also said that she is unsure whether appellant has an actual drinking problem. And Dr. Reitman, again, quoting or paraphrasing, wrote that appellant had a lot of DWIs. Both that's inaccurate on two counts. One, they were DUIs, technical variation, I understand. But also, she did not have a lot. She had those two. In the first one, her blood alcohol content was not sampled, so it is unknown. And in the second one, it was 0.06, which is below even the legal limit to operate a motor vehicle. Now, despite writing that Ms. Liner's alcohol use was unknown in court, Dr. Reitman testified that appellant's use was habitual, citing concerns that she was using alcohol while taking medication and that she was experiencing relapses. And there is simply no evidence at all to support either of those contentions. There was no indication that the court-appointed examiner spoke to any collateral sources before this reporting, and there's simply a complete lacking of information as to whether Ms. Liner was on medication at all, for instance, and was using that with alcohol, or that she had attempted to abstain from alcohol and had relapsed from that. Dr. Reitman's report, and especially his testimony on this issue, are unreliable and don't provide sufficient evidence to support a commitment. The record is also lacking any evidence that appellant experienced any physical health symptoms associated with her alcohol use. She was held for days at a time in jails and other institutions without any indication of withdrawal symptoms, no DTs, no indications of cravings, no reports of falls or balance issues, diabetes, cirrhosis of the liver. And I'm not saying that these indications always need be present to commit a person as CD, but when the evidence to support is already so thin, it is certainly notable that there's simply a lack of additional evidence regarding that would suggest a habitual or excessive use. Also regarding her ability to self-manage or her ability to handle the ordinary occurrences of daily life, as it's sometimes been described. There's nothing in the record that suggests she was not getting adequate food or clothing or employment or medical care. she didn't comply with probation. That I think that's fairly obvious if that's considered an ordinary occurrence of life, but that's also in no way associated with her use of alcohol. Her probation violations were never for her using alcohol when she wasn't supposed to be. There was some writing regarding home insecurity or whether she might be homeless, but again, that simply wasn't substantiated. She complied with home monitoring, alcohol home monitoring for weeks, which would, again, strongly suggest that she wasn't homeless. And again, even if there was an issue with housing insecurity, there's no indication it was because she was chemically dependent. And finally, whether there's a substantial likelihood of harm associated with her chemical use. Dr. Marshall, in her report, writes that appellant does not pose an imminent risk of harm to herself or others. And Dr. Reitman's report is similarly not specific or provide example as to how Ms. Thiner's chemical use presents a risk of harm to herself or others. It's very similar on the commitment as mentally ill. The essential requirement here, or one of the essential requirements, is that the mental illness poses a substantial likelihood of physical harm or self to other, or physical harm to self or others. And again, there's nothing in the record that suggests that she was experiencing homelessness specifically, or she was unable to obtain food or clothing, or attempted to harm herself or others, or damaged anybody's property. Again, Dr. Marshall wrote that appellant does not pose this imminent risk of harm to herself or others. Dr. Reitman basically summarized his concerns about harm to self in that appellant is not taking or cannot take care of her medical or psychiatric needs. First, there was nothing in the record regarding her physical health or whether she was not meeting her physical health needs. And regarding psychiatric health, beyond claiming that she was not taking care of her psychiatric needs, he doesn't provide any examples of this or how this represents a risk of physical harm or of self to others. What he wrote in his report is that she may present a risk of harm to others because she might be providing therapy to children, which is very tenuous given the record here. And perhaps this is a circular argument, but if she is hired into a position where she's providing therapy to children, what exactly is the severity of her mental health issue? I mean, if that's really what we're concerned about here. And Ms. Thiner self-reported that she was receiving mental health counseling.
May I just ask on that, Mr. Winkler, is the record unclear as to whether that's like fabricated or delusional, or whether she's in fact hired for that position?
My review of the record is it's not determined one way or another. Dr. Reitman seems to treat it as both a delusion in his report, but then expresses concern that it is in fact a reality. And I don't see that it was pressed any further as far as actual evidence one way or another. So I do not know the status of her employment at the time or whether she in fact had received this job or not. The record suggests that she had the training to obtain a job like this, but whether she actually had it or not, I don't know. I would finally note that respondent in their brief writes that appellant's delusional thinking does not independently raise concerns that appellant may pose a danger to herself or others, but that it is not benign. Again, that's not exactly a concession on the issue, but if we're looking solely at whether appellant was experiencing delusions, there's some acknowledgement here that they themselves are not sufficient to demonstrate that she poses a risk to herself or others. That they're not benign, perhaps they're causing some or could cause some harm. They note that she sought a foster care license, and there was concern that she was trying to get custody or was getting it so she could get custody of her grandchildren. Again, none of that actually happened. And again, it does not indicate there was actual harm to herself or others.
Mr. Winkler, I have one question. And that's a lot of your argument hinges on sort of the gaps in the analysis of Dr. Reitman. But the record indicates that, you know, part of those gaps were caused by the fact that your client didn't show up for, I think it's three, well, several scheduled interviews with the doctor. How should we as the court treat the fact that, you know, Dr. Reitman is trying to write this report, you know, with the information that was available to him, given your client's, you know, failure to appear for those appointments?
Certainly. One, that was the one issue that at the district court level, Ms. Thiner pushed back on. She had indicated that she did not receive notices of those hearings, or she received the wrong instructions, and was fairly adamant throughout that that was in fact the case. But Dr. Reitman's analysis and his report does not hinge on his meeting with the person, the Ms. Thiner in this case, directly. In fact, it's often determined that what that person says in that interview is simply self-serving and not reliable anyway, because, hey, they might be mentally ill. There are collateral sources that were available to Dr. Reitman. There were medical records available to Dr. Reitman. There are myriad other sources that Dr. Reitman could have used to fill those gaps in his report, but they're simply not there, and they remain gaps, and important gaps, and gaps that this court should consider when determining whether this evidence was sufficient. If there are no other questions, my time is about to expire here, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have the opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. McGowan.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Taylor McGowan, Martin County attorney, on behalf of Human Services of Faribault and Martin County. With respect to the first issue, which Mr. Winkler correctly noted that we have conceded as far as to the factual findings made by the district court, or I guess in this case, the lack thereof. Human Services argues that basically is dispositive of this appeal and that remand is appropriate. In our research, we did actually find a case where the Court of Appeals has addressed circumstances similar to this and determined that a remand is appropriate. And the case that we found is an unpublished decision, State v. Sabin. It's A-16-07-11. And in that case, which dealt with a continued commitment as opposed to an initial commitment, essentially the court in that case, the district court in that case, did the same as it did here. It made conclusory findings without any specific factual findings. And the court, upon review, determined that the district court had not met the statutory criteria in making its findings and felt that remand was appropriate. And when the court addressed basically the question of whether the record was sufficient for the commitment, the court held that effective appellate review of the argument is not possible until the district court makes findings about what evidence it relied on in reaching its conclusions. So while that case, obviously because it's unpublished, is not precedential in any way, I think it does illustrate that the court has addressed this, and that's been how it has handled situations similarly.
And just to be clear, that so in that case, the court did not engage in any review of the sufficiency of the evidence?
Correct.
Thank you.
Simply remanded to the district court.
And in that case, I guess I'm assuming for your argument, the record is closed. Under your concession, the remand is simply for the district court to look at the record as has already been developed. Or do you think that our remand is also to reopen the record?
If we're going to, I guess, be consistent with what the court has done previously, in the Sabin case that I just mentioned, the court ended by saying that whether to reopen the record on remand is discretionary with the district court. So I guess, you know, it would it just be a matter of whether the district court, with kind of, you know, advised of the need to make specific findings, felt that it is necessary to reopen the record. It would be up to the judge to do that. But nonetheless, as you know, the record that we do have, I don't believe that it is so lacking as to warrant outright reversal of the commitment. I think in this case, there was, you know, a pre-petition screening that was performed following a Rule 20 examination, and then another examination done by Dr. Reitman. All of these examinations basically identified or uniformly identified first that Ms. Steiner had an issue with alcohol consumption. That conclusion was derived from the fact that she had picked up two DWIs in relatively short succession. And also there was indications from Ms. Steiner's daughter that there had been alcohol consumption issues. While there isn't much more than that, I think as the court noted in their questioning of Mr. Winkler, part of that is due to Ms. Steiner's non-compliance with Dr. Reitman's examination, as well as her, well, evasive and somewhat delusional responses to questioning done by Dr. Marshall and the screening team. So I think there is, from what we have before us, sufficient evidence to, at least for the district court to find that that Ms. Steiner does have a chemical dependency issue, and that it does cause issues with her self-management or ability to obtain, you know, in this case, appropriate housing. Repeated inquiries into where Ms. Steiner was living never, I think, produced a stable address. There were indications, I think, from her son that he had to put her up in housing. One of the interviews, she also indicated that she could not provide an address, only a phone number. In light of that, the district court has to go and they have to specifically note what that they're relying on. But nonetheless, there is facts in the record as it exists right now to support a finding of that nature. I don't believe the record is so deficient to warrant just outright reversal at this time. The same can be said for the commitment under mental illness. Again, there is uniformity in all the examinations that Ms. Feiner suffers from some type of unspecified psychiatric illness, and that illness does pose a risk of harm to herself or to others. Again, you know, the record is not perfect, partly due to Ms. Steiner's kind of non-compliance with the interview process and the lack of generally kind of a social structure providing, you know, I guess, you know, what Mr. Winkler referred to as collateral sources to determine, you know, what her lifestyle is like. The pre-petition screening team got a hold of Ms. Steiner's children, tried to get a hold of, you know, different entities that she had worked with. But obviously there's a limited resources there because there doesn't seem to be much indication that, you know, Ms. Steiner has that stable social environment to that knows her and can report on her behavior. But again, what that there is in the record is concerning. She exhibits delusional behavior, which I believe also indicates kind of feeds into her issues with chemical dependency. She has no appreciation for her alcohol consumption and what dangers that poses. When she's been asked whether she even consumes alcohol, she's completely denied it, despite the fact that in her arrest in Blue Earth County for DWI, she did submit to a breath test and was positive for it. So in light of, you know, her clear psychosis, how that is fed into her lack of stable housing, her chemical dependency issues, as well as other, you know, indications of, I believe there was a potential employer reported that she had been stalking an individual. There, again, there is sufficient evidence in the record for the district court, should it so choose, to find that a commitment under the mental illness subdivision is appropriate. And as I mentioned before, I believe that the first issue on this appeal is dispositive, that this simply should be remanded for the district court to make factual findings so we can, I guess, further kind of flesh out the basis for the commitment and what particularly in the factual record the district court felt was appropriate to warrant Ms. Theiner's commitment. But nonetheless, as I mentioned, it's not so deficient as to warrant outright reversal. So with that, I will, if the court has any questions for me.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Winkler?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I would be interested also in an answer to my question in terms of whether you think that if we decide that a remand is appropriate, whether that would be a remand on the current record or whether the district court should be allowed to reopen the record.
Yes, I suppose it's a benefit of technology that normally wouldn't be available to me. As the Staben case that respondent referred to was not briefed, I did not have an opportunity to respond to it directly in a responsive brief, for instance. But I did have the opportunity to look into it while I was listening. I would first note that that case also cites to In re Stewart, which is a 1984 Court of Appeals case. It's 352 Northwest 2D 811. Quoting from it, it reports that in that case, the district court ordered continued commitment of Mr. Stewart after he was found to be schizophrenic. And this court, the Court of Appeals, concluded that while the evidence supported the district court's decision, the district court failed to comply with, by not specifying the conduct that supported its determination, the requisite statute. So again, I have not had an opportunity to review or brief this in any detail, but that quote strongly suggests that this court, the Court of Appeals, is capable of reviewing the evidence and that they made a determination that the evidence supported the district court's decision. As to whether this court decides just to remand and whether the record should be reopened at this point. I guess my concern would be, what is the scope of review for the district court at that point, in that we've had several months of Ms. Theiner being confined, of additional records being produced, of and is that evidence now part of the record, or capable of being part of the record? Is our cutoff date from the time the district court first heard this? And again, I mean, this is something that accrued over several months here. I mean, there was first the Rule 20.01 evaluation, a report drafted for that, a commitment that followed, several times when Ms. Theiner was jailed for failing to comply with her probation, for whatever reason that might be. I mean, there were months to develop a record for this court to make a detailed determination as to whether she was mentally ill and chemically dependent. And the record is simply the record. I understand that there might be issues with resources at the county level or other issues that could cause a limitation of that record, but it's not like this hearing occurred after she was placed on a 72-hour hold and there was a mad scramble to make a determination. There was, you know, months available to both her treatment team, Dr. Marshall and Dr. Reitman, to find that evidence, that adequate evidence that would support that she's mentally ill and chemically dependent under the statute. So my answer, frankly, would be no. I believe the record is the record. And if this is considered by the district court, it should remain that record for consideration as to whether that evidence was provided. I'm at a bit of a disadvantage because I did not represent Ms. Thiner at the district court level. So, you know, the accessibility of other witnesses, of other people that might have been available either to her or to the district, or to the county, one way or another, for that additional evidence, I do not have great insight into. I know the record as the record currently stands. So I suppose that was a long, almost 5-minute answer to your question there. So for that, I apologize. I would finally note that at her first DUI arrest, she told police at the time that she consumed one alcoholic beverage. The bartender at the place that she was arrested at indicated that they had served her one alcoholic beverage. So I know Mr. McGowan had indicated that she has been completely elusive regarding all of this stuff, but she has made one comment about her alcohol use directly as it pertained to an arrest, and that was supported by a corroborating witness. And with that, I thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much, counsel. This case has been